the headlines this hour. China and Russia blast NATO over its position against Beijing and Moscow at the Alliance Summit in Madrid. NATO says it is ready to help Ukraine obtain a wide range of modern military equipment, urging Russia to withdraw its forces from the country. Plus, Iran's foreign minister says an agreement is possible over the revival of the 2015 deal should the United States adopt a realistic approach.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us.
China censors NATO over what it calls a completely futile warning in which the Western military alliance declared that Beijing's power poses a strategic challenge.
NATO's so-called strategy concept document disregards the facts, gives a false account of the true facts, wrongly defines China as posing a strategic challenge, and smears China's foreign policy. It opposes China's normal military development and national defense policy, is irresponsible, encourages conflict, and is full of Cold War thinking and ideological prejudice. China is seriously concerned and firmly opposed to this.
Beijing warned NATO against hyping up the, quote, China threat, calling on its leaders to abandon the outdated concept. NATO leaders held a two-day summit in Madrid, where they put China in the crosshairs. They said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties with Russia threaten NATO. Meanwhile, in Moscow, President Putin has said that there would be no problem if Finland and Sweden joined NATO. The Russian president's remarks followed an announcement by NATO that it would welcome such a membership. Putin, however, said that Russia would respond if Finland and Sweden become a ground for the deployment of NATO troops. The president said that it was inevitable that Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm would sour after receiving NATO membership. NATO says that it is ready to help Ukraine obtain a wide range of modern military equipment, urging Russia to withdraw its forces from the country. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that Russia's war against Ukraine was, quote, brutal and absolutely unacceptable. He said that Sweden and Finland will sign on Tuesday the NATO accession protocol to formally join the alliance. The comments came 2 days after NATO member Turkey lifted its veto over the accession. The U.S. has announced another massive weapons package for Ukraine on the final day of the NATO summit in Madrid. President Joe Biden unveiled a new package worth $800 million. He said that it includes air defense and artillery, among other supplies. Biden said that Ukraine should receive the goods in the coming days. This is the latest in a series of Western arms shipments to Kiev. On Monday, Washington announced that it would send sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine. According to officials, the U.S. aid to Ukraine since February has been over $6 billion. Moscow blames the West for prolonging the conflict by sending more weapons to Kiev.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western military alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats, and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
From Donetsk, correspondent Johnny Miller talks about how NATO and Western policymakers are pushing Ukraine towards a prolonged war with Russia.
I don't think NATO has any regard whatsoever about the Ukrainian soldiers dying in this war. They are completely outmatched by the Russian army. I have no doubt, for example, if it was a British army there who was outmatched on the battlefield, NATO would withdraw that army. But they're not doing that for NATO, for Ukraine. They're pushing Ukrainians to continue to fight. And many analysts have said some time ago, increasingly say now, that Ukraine can't win this war. Russia is systematically destroying the Ukrainian army. And more Ukrainians are being called up to fight. So it's civilians who are dying, Ukrainian soldiers particularly are dying. Of course, we don't know the Russian figures, but they are dying as well. And it seems, as you rightly say, that NATO is just pushing for continued war. The most recent statement coming out of America, it's a different statement almost every day, but the most recent statement is that they think that Russia is trying to take over most of Ukraine. And if that's their policy, then that means their policy is to continue the fight, because Russia would be very open to negotiating a peaceful end to this conflict based around giving up some territory in the south and in the east. And for the United States to suggest that Russia wants to take the whole of Ukraine or most of Ukraine, they're essentially saying that we want Ukraine to continue to fight. And of course, NATO doesn't really have the interests of Ukrainian soldiers or the well-being of Ukrainian cities at heart. It's not going to affect their politicians at the ballot box. They can continue to fight Russia to the forlorn hope of damaging Russian power, of trying to damage the Russian army.
Russian forces have pulled out of Ukraine's Snake Island in the Black Sea, citing humanitarian reasons for the move. Russia's defense ministry says the withdrawal was a gesture of goodwill. Moscow says the troops have been done with their tasks in the region. The Kremlin says Russia is not seeking to impede efforts by the UN to open a humanitarian export corridor for Ukraine. In Kyiv, however, the government has a different narrative. It says it was Ukrainian forces who drove the Russian troops out after a massive overnight assault. Kyiv has hailed, quote, foreign countries for their military assistance. Russia captured the strategic outpost on the first day of its offensive in Ukraine in late February. Kyiv and its Western allies say that Moscow is blockading Ukrainian ports to prevent exports of grain. Russia dismisses that accusation. In Afghanistan, several explosions and heavy gunfire have been reported near the venue of the Afghan Jirga, or the Assembly of Ulema in the capital Kabul. We were joined earlier by our Kabul-based correspondent Abdullah Amirzadeh, who filled us in on what is known about the incident.
Several explosions were heard and heavy gunfire. We do not know about the number of casualties, but Zabihullah Mujahid, the spokesman of the IAEA, has announced that he would have a press conference today in the following hours. Yesterday, actually, there was preparation for this grand meeting. The roads were closed, and the number of security soldiers and the protocols were increased very much. But today this happened, these explosions and barrage of fire. We do not actually know anything about that yet because Taliban officials have not announced any details on this.
The Iranian foreign minister says an agreement is possible over the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA if the United States takes a realistic approach. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Iran is resolved to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement. He made the remarks in a phone call with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani. Amir Abdollahian said that Iran has always taken part in the JCPOA revival negotiations with initiatives aimed at reaching an acceptable agreement. Al Thani, whose country hosted indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions earlier this week, described the talks as constructive and positive. He said that Qatar is ready to host further talks until a desirable agreement is reached and that all parties return to their commitments under the 2015 deal. The accord was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally quit it in 2018 and reinstated the sanctions against Iran. Iran has marked the National Day of Fight Against Chemical and Biological Weapons. The occasion is to commemorate the victims of the Sardasht chemical attacks launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in June 1987. Salman Khujuri has more.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies when Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belong to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
On to Syria. An Iranian firm has rehabilitated part of the Aleppo power plant, a step towards reviving Syria's industrial hub whose electricity grid was destroyed during the years-long conflict. Iran's Mapna Group has repaired the fifth unit of the plant, bringing over 200 megawatts back to Aleppo's power grid. The first unit will also be ready for operation soon. The station, which is 5 units, produced over 1.1 thousand megawatts before the Syria conflict. It is one of the biggest plants in the country. The Iranian firm started the project in 2017, after Iran and Syria signed a memorandum of understanding to restore electrical infrastructure in the Arab country. The plant was reportedly hit by the U.S. warplanes a few years ago and went out of service. Israeli lawmakers have voted on the dissolution of the Knesset, a development that marks the end of Naftali Bennett's tenure as prime minister. The dispersal of the parliament will fuel continued political instability in Israel, pushing the regime towards its fifth election in just over 3 years. The lawmakers have also voted to hold the elections on November the 1st. Last week, Bennett moved to dissolve the Knesset after his ruling coalition collapsed following a series of defections. The prime minister says that he will not run in the upcoming election. His predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, has called Bennett's administration the worst in Israel's history. Netanyahu is planning a comeback by winning a sixth term in office, even though he's on trial for a number of corruption charges. In Sudan, 4 more protesters have been killed by security forces after thousands of people took to the streets to call for an end to military rule. Medical sources with the protest movement say that the deaths bring the toll from months of protest-related violence to 107. Media reports say security forces fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the demonstrators. Over the past 8 months, the protesters have demanded the reversal of an October military coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The coup in 2021 toppled a mixed civilian-military transitional government that was formed following a 2019 coup ousting Omar al-Bashir. The latest protests mark the third anniversary of the huge demonstrations that overthrew Bashir. And with an update on that news, death toll at this point has risen to 5. Tens of thousands are out protesting against the military rule in Sudan, so the death toll now has increased to 5 there in Sudan. Italy's economy is facing multiple threats. The gas squeeze, higher interest rates, and plummeting consumer confidence are threatening to bring down the country's economy on multiple fronts. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy. Just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic, a combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civilli, Rome.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Imam Javad, martyrdom in the prime of youth. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Heartfelt condolences to you all on a very doleful day. The last day of the month of Dhul-Qa'dah is the martyrdom anniversary of the 9th infallible era of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He was the Prophet's namesake and was known by his famous epithets of Taqi, or the most pious one, and Jawad, or the most generous, in both material and spiritual matters. He was martyred in the prime of youth through a fatal dose of poison, and rest in peace in the sprawling twin-domed gold-plated shrine of Qasimain near Baghdad, besides his grandfather, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him. Before we present you an exclusive feature on the life and times of the ninth Imam, here is a wonderful saying from him. Delay in repentance is self-deceit. Long procrastination is confusion, and it is self-destruction to resort to excuses before Allah while insisting on sins by feeling safe from divine punishment of Allah. Do the people of the towns feel secure from our punishment overtaking them at midday while they are playing around? The words which you heard are indeed food for thought. These are not the utterances of any ordinary person. As a matter of fact, these bezels of wisdom were bequeathed to us for our guidance by the most perfect and excellent person of his times, whose tragic martyrdom we commemorate every year on the last day of the month of Dhul-Qa'dah. Born in 195 AH in Medina, and named Muhammad in honor of his ancestor, the Prophet, the ninth Imam needs no introduction. His mother was the pure and pious Nubian lady named Sabiqatu Zahab, or Gold in God. He was 6 years old when his father, Imam Reza, peace upon him, was forced to leave his hometown for distant Khorasan in 201 for the city of Marv, the capital of the self-styled Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun. It was a painful farewell between father and son and brought tears to the eyes of the onlookers. It was sure for both that the eighth Imam was destined not to return home to Medina from the long journey, and hence the ninth Imam was already visualizing himself as an orphan at this tender age. Imam Reza, peace upon him, gave due instruction to his close companions regarding his son, making it clear that by God's will, he was his successor despite his childhood. When asked by one of his followers, "My master, God forbid, if something were to happen to you in your journey, to whom will authority belong?" Imam Reza, peace upon him, replied in a calm and composed manner, "To Abu Ja'far." When the surprised questioner indicated that the age of the boy was too young, Imam Reza, peace upon him, said with a smile, "Allah, may he be praised, raised Jesus, son of Mary, as a messenger, a prophet, and bringer of a revealed law to begin his mission when his age was younger than that of my son Abu Ja'far." Imam Jawad, peace upon him, was thus 8 years old when the mantle of divinely decreed imamat came to rest on his tender shoulders on the martyrdom of Imam Reza, peace upon him, in Khorasan. For the next 17 years, the ninth Imam ably discharged his responsibilities despite the intensity of the Abbasid plots, until his untimely martyrdom in 220 AH in Baghdad. He was martyred through a fatal dose of poisoning in the prime of his youth, at the age of 25 years, by a self-styled caliph who thought that the death of the ninth imam of the Ahl al-Bayt would ensure longevity to the rule of the usurper Abbasid regime. Mu'tasim was utterly wrong, and the misdeed he committed against Imam Muhammad Taqi al-Jawad, peace upon him, ensured for the self-styled caliph a lasting place in the infernal flames of hell, while the rich legacy of his victim continues to be alive and invigorating to this day. The unpardonable crime of Mu'tasim was committed on the threshold of the annual Hajj pilgrimage to the holy Mecca, where every year the ninth Imam used to be present in the garb of the exemplary pilgrim to teach the tenets of Islam to visitors from far and near. Many still vividly remembered the question that a grey-bearded ideologue of Mu'tazilite sect, Yahya ibn Akfam, had posed over a decade ago to Imam Jawad, peace upon him, who then was a beardless boy, and gave the most logical answer. This is not something to feel surprise about, since God Almighty informs us in Ayah 12 of Surah Maryam that He gave wisdom to John the Baptist, or Prophet Yahya, while still a boy. In the same Surah, Ayah 30, the Lord Most High also informs us that the virgin-born Jesus, peace upon him, though still an infant in the cradle, was empowered to speak to the doubting Israelites about the chastity of his mother and the fact that he was entrusted with the heavenly scripture and prophethood. Thus, Yahya ibn Akhtham, on the instructions of the then Caliph Ma'mun, had asked, "What is the atonement for a person who hunts a game while he is dressed in the pilgrimage garb, that is, ihram?" This question appears quite simple, especially during the Hajj season when every potential pilgrim tries to acquaint himself or herself with the rules before setting off to Mecca, circumambulate the Holy Kaaba, the symbolic house of the unseen but omnipresent Lord. But the questioner had ulterior motives. He intended to ensnare in the intricacies of legal issues what appeared to him as a mere boy. However, to the astonishment of the scholar and the whole court, the lad, Imam Jawad, peace upon him, with composure and wisdom beyond his tender years, said, "Your question is utterly vague and lacks definition. You should first clarify whether the game killed was outside the sanctified area or inside it, whether the hunter was aware of his sin or did so in ignorance. Did he kill the game purposely or by mistake? Was the hunter a slave or a free man? Was he adult or minor? Did he commit the sin for the first time or had he done so before? Was the hunted game a bird or something else? Was it a small animal or a big one? Is the sinner sorry for the misdeed or does he insist on it? Did he kill it secretly at night or openly during daylight? Was he putting on the pilgrimage garb or for Hajj or for the Umrah? Unless you clarify and define these aspects, how can you have a definite answer?" At this reply, Yahya ibn Akhtham stuttered and couldn't find any answer to the counter question posed by the boy imam. His claim to knowledge shattered before the whole court. The grey-haired scholar changed his tone and humbly addressed the boy with the words, "O son of the prophet, you know better." The admission of inability by the learned doctor of law embarrassed Ma'mun and evaporated his dreams of humiliating ninth infallible heir of the prophet. The Imam then obliged by saying, "If the pilgrim had killed the animal outside the sacred ground, and it was winged and large, an atonement of a sheep would have been necessary for him. If he had struck it down in the sanctuary, the penalty required him would be doubled. If he killed a young bird outside the sacred ground, then the atonement of a lamb which had been weaned off milk would have been required of him. If he had killed it in the sanctuary, then he would have been required to sacrifice a lamb and the value of the young bird. As for wild animals, if it was a wild ass, he would have been required to sacrifice a cow. If it was an ostrich, the sacrifice of a camel would be necessary. If it had been a deer, then a sheep would have been necessary. If he had killed any of those in the sanctuary, the penalty would have been doubled." Imam Jawad, peace upon him, continued to describe the various penalties for the pilgrim in the state of ihram to the astonishment of the audience. Those interested can refer to the book Kitab al-Irshad of the famous scholar Sheikh Mufid, compiled over 1,000 years ago. Mu'tasim also remembered this vivid debate held over 12 years ago, yet he was so blind to the truth that he forced Imam Jawad, peace upon him, to leave Medina on the threshold of the Hajj pilgrimage and come to his capital Baghdad in Iraq so as to be under the watchful eyes of the regime. It was clear Mu'tasim was looking for a pretext to poison the Imam at the first opportunity. Once a thief was brought before Mu'tasim, and the jurisprudence in his court gave conflicting verdicts, with some saying that the culprit's hand he severed from the wrist, some said it should be cut off from the elbow, while others opined that the whole arm to be chopped off. When Mu'tasim turned to the ninth imam and insisted on his opinion in this regard, the prophet's rightful successor said that the mode of Islamic punishment for a habitual thief, according to the genuine laws of the Sharia, is that only the four fingers, and that too after due warnings, should be severed, leaving the thumb and the palm intact. Since the culprit is after all a human being in need of the mercy of the all-forgiving God and should not be deprived of the correct way to pray, which requires the touching of seven organs to the ground, including the palms. After this wise and rational judgment, the malice of the caliph and the court mullahs increased, and they plotted the murder of Imam Jawad, peace upon him, through poisoning. The caliph, afraid of the popularity of the imam and fearful of his own flimsy claims to rule the Muslims, plotted with his niece, Umm Fazl, the imam's treacherous wife, to martyr Imam Javad, peace upon him, by poisoning his food. He was gleeful with joy as reports reached his palace at regular intervals that the fatal dose of poison was having the desired effects on his innocent victim. As the husband writhed in acute pain, the traitorous wife stopped the maids and servants from providing any antidote to the venerable descendant of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today, there is no sign of the graves of the accursed Abbasid, let alone their palaces. While Imam Javad, peace upon him, who reposes in eternal peace beside his grandfather, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, in the magnificent gold-plated, twin-domed mausoleum of Kazemain, continues to rule the hearts and minds of believers all over the world.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected brothers, sisters, we've gathered here this evening for commemorating the Shahada anniversary of our ninth Imam, Imam Muhammad Al-Jawad Al-Taqi, And on this occasion, I want to express my condolences to the living Imam, the Imam of our time, Ajlal Farj of Sharif, and to all the lovers and the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Imam al-Ridha alayhi as-salam was martyred when Imam Muhammad al-Jawad was only, according to some reports, 7 or some say 8 years old. And in doing this, when this happened, Imam Muhammad al-Jawad became the youngest of the imams. Never before was there an imam who was that age when he became the imam. And this was something that was new for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that somebody who other people would consider to be a child, other people would consider that age of 7 or 8 to be an age which is immature. And here, the Shias were instructed very clearly from Imam Ridha alayhi salam that after me, the Hujjah of Allah on the earth is my son Muhammad, Abu Ja'far. He's the one who's going to be your Imam. Now, there are some people who might look at this and say that, well, you know, isn't this something which is kind of like maybe, na'udhu billah, something to be a little bit shy about telling other people that one of our imams became the imam at the age of 7 or 8? Some people might think that. Because after all, usually people who become leaders are mature. You know, at least, let's say, 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, when they've experienced, that's typically the way that they are. What happened here? Why is it that this happened, that a child is being put there? Is that something that we need to maybe be shy about telling others about and maybe, you know, kind of not look into it too much? Actually, brothers and sisters, one of the sources of pride for the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is that among the imams, there were not just one, not just two, but there was 3 of them who became the imam at a very young age. The 9th imam, the 10th imam, and the imam of our time. And this is a point of pride. And inshallah, I want to look at this. Like, what is it? How can we understand this? Because sometimes we get confused. You know, you might see this when we do salah. When we have somebody who is a child who's not baligh, some people get really like kind of excited. They're like, oh no, there's a child who's not baligh, right? We need to make sure that there's somebody else who's the point of connection for them. Right? Why is that? Because sometimes there's this conception that, okay, if a child's not baligh, they can't even hold a connection in jama'ah. Now, you know that the correct hukum, the correct ruling on that is that if a child is mumayyiz for salah, meaning that they know how to pray, right? They know what prayer is about and they know how to pray, they can be a connection in salat al-jama'ah. But we have many rulings in Islam which say that if somebody is not baligh, then they cannot perform this responsibility. For example, let's say that there is a child who has a lot of property. They themselves do not have, like if they go and let's say they want to sell something like a large sum of money, they want to, I don't know, buy some Bitcoin or something like that. That, according to Islam, it would not be a valid transaction. Why? Because the child is not baligh. In Islam, let's say that there's Islamic law, let's say that there's a group of children who are not baligh. Let's say there's a group of boys who are, let's say, you know, from, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Is it allowed for one of them, and it's time comes for prayers, is it allowed for one of them to come and lead the prayers for the others? Islamic law says that the only one who is qualified to lead the prayers for a group is one who is baligh. Even if you don't have a baligh person there, it's not correct, according to the maraji, that one of them should step forward and he should lead for the others. That's how important it is for somebody to be baligh according to Islamic law. So sometimes when, you know, this is those who grow up and they understand the laws, right? They come to this like, wait, but we have imams who, for example, the imam of our time at 5 years old, Imam Jawad at 7, you know, so these are things which bring up questions. One thing I want to state here is that these laws that we learn, they are general laws, but when it comes to these matters, when it comes to the matter of who is it that has the authority, when it comes to who is going to be the leader, when somebody is ma'asum, and that isma is something which is granted by Allah, then that person is accepted from these types of rules. And what is the proof from this? For this, it comes from the Quran itself. The Quran teaches us that at times throughout history, Allah has made a child be the representative of His on the earth. We have the example of Nabi Yahya alayhi salam. We have the example of Nabi Isa alayhi salam. There was one time where one of the companions, his name was Ali ibn Asbat. Ali ibn Asbat was from Egypt. He had traveled all the way to, I believe it was Medina, to see Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam. And when he comes to see him, he's looking at him in a lot of detail. He's trying to like almost memorize everything that he's seeing. Now why is he doing this? The hadith says, he says to Imam Muhammad al-Jawad, he says that when I go back to Egypt, I want to be able to describe for the people exactly what I've seen. I want to be able to tell them everything that I saw, all your features, everything about you. And at that point, Imam Muhammad Jawad, he knows what is going on in Ali ibn Asbat's mind. That he's going to have to go to Egypt and he's going to have to educate the Shias who are there that your Imam, you know, now that Imam Ridha alayhi salam has been martyred, now your Imam is going to be somebody who you might think is just a child. You might think that it's an age which is immature, but that's not the case. So in that gathering with Ali ibn Asbat, Imam Jawad alayhi salam, he goes into sujood and he makes a dua. And then he quotes a couple of the ayat of the Quran. One of the ayats he quotes is the verse about Nabi Yahya alayhi salam, وَآتَيْنَاهُ الْحُكْمَ الصَّبِيَّةِ. Allah said in the Quran that we gave him the hukm. The hukm in the Quran, sometimes it refers to the authority of prophethood. In this case, that's what it is. We gave him the authority of prophethood when he was a sabi, he was just a child. And then he quotes another verse from the Quran. Hatta idha balagha ashuddahu wa balagha arba'ina sana. He says that that sometimes Allah chooses to give hikmah and wisdom to somebody who is arba'in sana, somebody who is 40 years old. But typically, if somebody is going through the proper process of tarbiyah, they are following the sharia, they are reflecting, they are learning, then they go through a process of maturing, and that process, it hits its peak at 40 years old, typically. But the Imam Jawad says that sometimes Allah chooses to give that hukm at an earlier age as well. So he uses the Quran to show that this is the way it is. That even when Allah chooses, there can be somebody who is even at a younger age, and that person can become the imam. Now why? What is the philosophy behind this? This is very interesting. Why is it that Allah wanted to arrange things this way? One of the reasons why, according to the historians, the expert scholars who have analyzed, you know, the incidents that took place, one of the reasons why Allah chose to put the imamah in somebody who was that young was because it was a test for the people. When they're commanded to follow some and do something that they didn't expect, how are they going to, you know, how are they going to react? One of the things we find in history is that for the most part, all of the Shias who followed Imam Ridha alayhi salam, eventually they followed Imam Muhammad Jawad, eventually they followed Imam Al-Hadi, eventually all the way Imam Askari, all the way until the Imam of the time. So for the most part, that they were tested and then they passed that test. And this was something that Allah wanted as a blessing for them, right? It's something which is good for them to be tested in that manner. But it's very interesting if we look at some of the other reasons why Allah wanted to do this. One of them is because Allah wants it to be the case that people very clearly know that Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam is the Imam. Now, what is the way that they are going to know that? When the Abbasid Khulafa are, you know, just clamping down so tight on the Shias, they're controlling access to the Imams. How is it they're going to know? One of the ways that they'll know is when they see that somebody who is so young
he's performing miraculous acts, then they'll be convinced that, okay, this is not coming just to something that he learned by himself. Definitely this is coming from a higher source. And we see this in the life of the Imam.
السلام عليك يا محمد بن علي أيها الجواد
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. He would not do things without calculating them first. And when he reached a result in that calculation, he would put it into action with complete decisiveness. There was no doubt and weaknesses in his work. He would never become disappointed. So many incidents occurred in the first year of the revolution, the martyrdom of many people and various other issues, but this never made him disappointed. He was honest in the literal sense of the word. He was honest with both God and the people. He would honor his promises. When he came to Tehran in the year 1357, Bahman XII, he said that he would form a government. At the speech in Behesht-e-Zahra, and he formed a government 4 days later. During those 4 days, he summoned the Revolutionary Council and we went there. Apparently, he had asked some members of the Revolutionary Council, Shahid Mutahhari, Shahid Beheshti, and the like, to find someone, but they had not managed to find a person yet. Imam was upset about that. He criticized them for not having taken action. He was like that.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
He was really disciplined and punctual. I myself witnessed this in many cases. He was a man who would rely on God in the real sense of the word. He believed in divine promises and was confident about them. And whoever puts their trust in God, then he alone is sufficient for them. This is Holy Quran, chapter 65, verse 3. He was the true embodiment of this ayah. He was a warrior. Later, I will explain what this means. He had such characteristics. Of course, he had other exemplary qualities as well. These were his personal qualities. As for his school of thought, principles and goals, if we wish to briefly explain the foundation of Imam's school of thought and revolution, we must say that the foundation for all his activities was rising up for the cause of God. The goal was to rise for the cause of God.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.